The Tom Woods Show, episode 818.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, I got some free ebooks for you to help you answer some of the most common objections to libertarianism. One of them is 14 Hard Questions for Libertarians Answered, then Bernie Sanders is Wrong, then Education Without the State, and more to come. Check him out at tomsfreebooks.com. Hi everybody, Tom Woods here talking to Michael Malice. That weasel Michael Malice is back here on the show. You know old Michael. He was voted the favorite guest on the Tom Woods Show when we did our Family Feud survey for the Contra Cruise, and we call it Freedom Feud. Michael came in first, and you're about to find out why. He, as you may know by now, is a celebrity ghostwriter. His most recent book hit the New York Times bestseller list. He's also the author in his own right of a book called Dear Reader, the unauthorized autobiography of Kim Jong-il. I'll be linking to that, as always, on the show notes page, which is tomwoods.com/818. You can find out more about Michael, whom you can see on Fox News and on Fox Business, particularly on Kennedy, on a regular basis. Find out more about Michael at michaelmalice.com. We're going to talk today about a book written by Murray Rothbard called The Betrayal of the American Right. I edited that and wrote the introduction for it, so I'll link to that in the show notes page as well. Michael recently read that book, and I thought, what the heck, let's talk about it and see what you thought of it. Michael, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Tom.
So we're going to talk about this book, The Betrayal of the American Right. I'm linking to it on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/818. People can actually read it for free online, or if they prefer a hard copy, they can grab it that way. This, it turns out, is the first Rothbard book you've read. Now, maybe you've read an article here or there, you've done some other reading, but here's your first cover-to-cover Rothbard book. And I have a unique perspective on this book, having been the editor of this thing. It was a manuscript that was in Rothbard's collection that a lot of people knew about, people had read over the years, and it had gone through various versions, and there had been various attempts to get it published, but for one reason or another, it never did get published. But yet he still was working on it right to the end. You can see edits on the original manuscript pages from the early 1990s. So he still did have the intention of having it see the light of day. And I'm sorry, I don't mean to just talk the whole time, but I just want to give a little bit of background. When it was up to me to write the introduction and do some editing on it, the main editing I did was really just to correct little typographical problems, whatever, but also to exercise some editorial judgment about what to do about a lot of the markouts that he had done. He had scribbled out a lot of text, and there was one person, I won't mention his name, who was urging me to revive that text and include it in the finished version. And my view was, I think we have an obligation to be faithful to Rothbard's desires as the author, and if he crossed this section out, then I think we have to honor that. So that was how I did it. I didn't put in stuff that he wouldn't have wanted published. But anyway, it is as close to an autobiography of Rothbard as we're obviously ever going to get. But it's also a kind of an intellectual history of the American right during an important period. So having said that as background, give me your initial thoughts on that book.
Well, let me give you a little bit of something, a background. One of the things that I know you are protective of Rothbard, as I'm protective of Rand, and one of the things I resent that progressives do is they will critique a person with some one sentence, but this implication is, well, since this person did this one thing, therefore they should be thrown into the garbage can, right? They love to dismiss people and denigrate them. So when I there's some things in here that I'm critical of. The book's great. I was resisting reading this for a long time, reading Rothbard for a long time, because I'm come from the Ayn Rand school. And as you know, Rand and Rothbard had a very contentious relationship. At first, when he was young, he came into her orbit. Then he thought she was a crazy person. The feeling was certainly mutual. And Rothbard is pretty much the main reason she refused to call herself a libertarian. And towards, you know, later in his life, he wrote that satirical play about her called Mozart Was a Red, where he completely eviscerated her. So I didn't want to read him for a long time. The one book I read about Rothbard was Justin Raimondo's biography called An Enemy of the State. And I got a very negative impression of him from that book as a person. But all my friends are anarchists. They're all anarcho-capitalists. They're all Rothbardians. And I'm like, look, maybe I'm secretly a Rothbardian and I don't know it. Let me give this guy a fair shake, especially because so many people who I hate hate him. So he can't be all bad. So the first thing about this book, and it's really, I think, the best history of the libertarian movement I've ever read. The guy is such a good writer. He knows how to tell a story. It's absolutely superb. Was that kind of exciting for you to edit that and just read it as just like a story?
Oh, sure, because it filled in details that I had always wondered about. Because there weren't a whole lot of anarcho-capitalists in the world at that time. So I always wanted to know, how did he get from minarchism to there? What right. was it? Or just his background, a little bit of where he came from and his early years. There's a lot of that stuff in there. And then toward the end, as I'm sure we'll get to, he goes into great detail about his time interacting with people on the new left. And that just, I mean, some of it made me want to pull my hair out, but some of his commentary about these people wanting to make the meeting like all of life, like we were going to make collective decisions on everything. And so we're going to have interminable meetings until we reach consensus. And he just thought, okay, maybe I've made a mistake after all.
Right. So one of the things that is kind of weird is he seems to have this idea throughout his life that given the very poor choices in politics we are being faced at any given point in time, it's important to make, you know, the right, I guess, coalition or pick the right side, as opposed to, I think now that he's gone, most of us realize there is no right side, that both sides are going to be terrible in their own way. And this idea that if you're really, you know, he came out for Adlai Stevenson, you know, because Adlai Stevenson was less pro-war than Eisenhower. And it's like Adlai, and then he's kind of surprised that, you know, Adlai Stevenson's not leading the way to anarcho-capitalism. And he seems, that's his theme. And I don't want to pick your brain about this because I don't know what you're going to say. He seems to, throughout his life, his theme is he gets on board these alliances with these different groups and he reads things into them that clearly aren't there and is then kind of disappointed that they are in no sense anarchists or even libertarians.
Well, I wouldn't say that he's surprised when it doesn't work out or when they do status things. He knew all the flaws of Pat Buchanan, for example, but he thought, all right, Pat is saying, look, let's stop waging all the wars. Let's shut down NATO. No one else is talking like that. So I'll jump onto this particular wagon. I think that was his outlook. But I mean, we never got to see what Adlai Stevenson would have done.
But, can we guess? I mean, it's not going to be.
Yeah. No, of course. No. That's true. But I think his view is, if I had to choose, I think I would choose somebody who would be less likely to expand the warfare state. Now, I actually had this discussion with, I better not say who, but somebody who argued that it's more significant and important to deal with healthcare than it is with foreign policy.
Okay.
And his argument was, doggone, I can't remember how he made the case. And I kind of felt like, look, healthcare, the policy changes that can occur, given the bureaucratic nightmare we live under and the competing fiefdoms at work, are going to be probably on the margin only. Whereas with foreign policy, it can be binary, yes or no, war or no war. Like I can actually do that and stop that. And so I actually had somebody saying, yeah, I don't really care that much about where a candidate stands on foreign policy. I care more about domestic policy because it's more lasting. Once we get a domestic policy in there, yeah, maybe this was the argument. Once we get a domestic policy in place, it never, ever gets repealed. Whereas foreign policy, well, eventually they do wear out their welcome. They do wind down the wars. So I don't care so much about foreign policy. I kind of do, but yet not so much that I could say to myself, woohoo, go Bernie against Donald Trump or something. I just would have to abstain.
Right. But he is saying woohoo, go Bernie at different times. And it's very weird that someone who is probably the biggest anarchist innovator of the, I mean, I don't even know who would be number two of the 20th century, is still looking to government for possible, and someone who's as cynical as him is still looking to government in some sense for possible solutions.
Yeah, let's talk about that. The thing is that I remember reading when Rothbard was arguing against the agorists, and I will not say agorists. I refuse. That's just that's a hideous neologism. But anyway, his argument in part was that there are some things that it's inconceivable they could be changed without government. So he said, I mean, look, the second bank of the U.S. was not gotten rid of because the people rose up against it and refused to use the currency.
Sure.
It's got rid of because Andrew Jackson didn't renew the charter. Or the corn laws in England. We got rid of the corn laws because, well, Parliament reversed them. Or slavery was abolished by government fiat. I mean, these things did happen. And some things, it's not clear how you could do them simply through some kind of black market alternative or parallel institutions.
Sure.
You do need government for some things, was his attitude. I mean, you don't need them to provide services.
Yes.
You need them to unprovide services.
Yes, and that's fair. But the people, to make actions like that, like let's suppose be an abolitionist, you have to have this kind of firm commitment to abolition. And I think so throughout the book, he's talking about like, oh, during this election, libertarians had no choice but to join with person A. And at another point, he's saying, well, at this point, libertarianism was down to me and Leonard Liggio. So when he's speaking about air quotes libertarians, I'm like, is he just mean himself? Like he talks about kind of being ahead of a. It's implied that he's the head of this big group, but it also sounds like it really was just him and like three people.
I think early on it kind of was him and three people in the sense that by the way, obviously that's not to say that he wouldn't work with people. I mean, he had close friends on the right. Like, for example, the godfather of two of my children is Roger McCaffrey. I've had on the show a couple of times. His father, Neil, started the Conservative Book Club, traveled in Bill Buckley's circles, and was very close with Rothbard, even though they disagreed on foreign policy. They loved jazz, and they hated the left, and that was pretty good foundation for a friendship. So he was willing to sit down, talk to, and work with a variety of people. But when it comes to and his view also was you got to be tougher on libertarians than you are on non-libertarians, because his view is I expect a libertarian to be a libertarian. I don't expect a non-libertarian to be a libertarian. So if he does a lot of things that annoy me, well, I knew he was going to do those things. So I think a lot of people got upset, for instance, when some of us were tough on Gary Johnson. Well, he's so much better than A and B. But I don't expect A and B to be any good. I expect them to be bums. I'm going to hold Gary Johnson to a higher standard because he represents this honorable tradition of thought, and I don't want him to screw it up.
You know, that's the thing. People often attack Rand for, you know, reading people out of her scene and going after them and kind of purging them. And they don't. He does the same exact thing as she did, but she gets that criticism and he doesn't. And I think he should get it just as much as her.
Well, this basically is going to boil down to people who knew him personally, because
throughout the book, he's going after people and just kind of eviscerating them. I'm not saying unwarrantedly, but I'm just saying he does exactly what she does, and she is the one who is carrying the water for it often.
Well, let's think about some specific examples. One thing that one of the major themes of the book is the rise of National Review, and basically it's Bill Buckley, Frank Meyer, James Burnham.
I'm looking at the page literally right now. I have it screen capped because I want to quote from it. But go ahead.
Okay. So, I mean, these are all very smart people, by the way.
Yeah.
And he doesn't deny that. But his point is that he just does not see how the Cold War apparatus can be reconciled with libertarianism, particularly given the tendency of government policies to stay in effect long after they've served their alleged purpose, which is clearly the case. Obviously, the U.S. military now doesn't even know what to do with itself, so it's searching around for things to do because it
right.
never will end. What possible incentive would it have to end? So he's saying that this is not what we were about. And I think he can legitimately go back to the 30s and say the people who were anti-New Deal were also anti-Franklin Roosevelt on foreign policy, whereas these people are all cheerleaders for it. So I don't think he's looking for, well, where do you stand on the privatization of lighthouses? I'm going to kick you out for that.
Well, here's the question. So are you familiar with the term red pill?
Oh, what do you think? I don't ever go to the movies?
Well, no, in terms of politics.
Well, okay, give me example. Give me what you mean by it.
So red pilling is an internet term that's kind of gained frequency in the last couple of years. That's why I asked. And it is a reference to the Matrix. And the point is, once someone is red pilled, they recognize that what they're taught through the media narrative is a complete myth and an illusion.
Right.
Now, the line I always say, and if any of you listeners quote me, you better damn give me credit or I'll come to your house. You're supposed to take one red pill and not the whole bottle. And I think at different times, Rothbard did take the whole bottle in the sense that once you think that a lot of what we're being taught is false and propaganda manipulation, you start throwing out the baby with the bathwater and you get down some dark rabbit holes. And let me just read a sentence from here that's exactly about the National Review, where he goes, "In light of hindsight, we should now ask whether or not the entire effort of the National Review was in essence a CIA operation." And he accuses Buckley and Burnham, who I love, as being CIA agents.
But Buckley was in the CIA.
But do you honestly think that the National Review was some kind of CIA psyops movement?
No, I personally don't. But I, at the same time, would not consider it crazy, given that has the CIA not tried to influence thought in other countries? Has it not funded magazines, publications, broadcasts of various kinds in all different countries, communist and non-communist, to sway opinion in particular directions? No question about it.
I'm not going to defend the CIA or deny anything you just said. I just think it gets tricky when you start musing out loud without really having anything to back it up that people are covert CIA agents.
What do you think about this claim that Russia hacked the election of 2016?
That sentence is, given the facts, nonsensical, as you know.
So
they did not hack an election. They at the very, very worst hacked John Podesta's email account and Hillary's server. Right. Hacking the election is exactly what I'm talking about with red pilling, is a lie, because that implies that they went to the voting machines and switched votes.
Right. And that clearly didn't happen.
And they're not even claiming that happened. So that very phrase is designed to be deceptive and manipulative.
Well, I would be willing to entertain speculation that there's something that I mean, given that we've even read that the CIA pushed modern art as a way to screw with the commies and make their art look backward. Because, hey, look, all the sophisticated people are doing this. I mean, the things that we've uncovered about the way they've tried to influence opinion are so overwhelming that founding some diddly magazine seems like child's play for them. But you're right. I can't demonstrate that, so I don't go around saying it.
Well, there's a great book called In Search of the Manchurian Candidate, which talks about the CIA, like mind control techniques over decades, and which I just read recently. It's fascinating. The point that book makes unintentionally is that they're really bad at it, and which is not a surprise that, you know, you have these government agencies trying to figure out how to, you know, brainwash and control mass populations. They're never going to be as good at it as Hollywood. And Hollywood isn't doing this, you know, necessarily with a gun to their head. They're doing this voluntarily because they have drank the progressive Kool-Aid and they know their marching orders. And I think that is a much more organic and coherent analysis of what's going on than this kind of, you know, psyops situation that like Roseanne Barr talks about constantly on Twitter.
All right. What else can we talk about? Because we're getting pretty far into it here.
Okay. So one of the other things he talks about explicitly is that and this is something you and I kind of mentioned before, he explicitly says that, here's the quote, "The United States, with the aid of Britain, was solely responsible for the Cold War. In a continuing harassment and aggression against the Soviet Union, whose foreign policy had been almost pathetic in its yearning for peace with the West at virtually any price."
Yeah, that's hardcore stuff. I agree. And I'm not sure I can sign on to that. I agree.
Okay, yeah.
At the same time, and now I'm sorry to sound like this, but at the same time, one can go back and look at Robert Taft's commentary about different Soviet moves, where his view, for example, when Truman gave his speech outlining the Truman Doctrine and talking about Greece and Turkey, well, Taft's view was, well, you know, there doesn't seem to be any real Russian threat here. The Russians have not allowed the Greek communists to join the common form. They're basically keeping to the agreement they made with Churchill there. Yeah, Russia has always wanted access to the Straits, so this is not some uniquely communist thing. And he just went and looked and said, this is not, or if the U.S. gets oil concessions in Iran, is it so totally crazy and insane for Iran, so close to the Soviet Union, to be asked to give the Soviets some type of oil concession? So, I mean, in other words, you look at it collectively, and just getting out of your head that it's run by a terrible guy and a terrible system that killed a lot of people, just looking at it objectively, it doesn't actually look like the foreign policy of a wild, insane lunatic.
Well, my point is there's plenty of blame to go around. And it's, in any geopolitics, it's never going to be this simplistic black and white. And to say that we are solely the bad guys, you know, when it comes to the Cold War, obviously there's going to be a lot of blowback and Soviet Union is going to react to things we're doing, no question. But the idea that they didn't have this kind of expansionist ideology and weren't bloodthirsty, I don't think that's true.
Yeah, I think they had an expansionist ideology and I think they were bloodthirsty, but I also think they had lost 27 million lives during the war. I think they were, after the war, they were ripping up railroad tracks going into the heart of Europe that presumably they would want to use if they intended to launch an attack. So I think there was reason to believe that they were spent for the time being anyway.
Sure. Yeah, but just because they weren't going to launch an attack, you don't have to be expansionist vis-a-vis war. You could be expansionist vis-a-vis propaganda and fomenting revolutions, which they did frequently.
Yeah, that's true.
That was their technique.
And the result was they wound up with all these third world hellhole basket cases draining them.
Oh, yeah.
How did that help?
I'm not saying it helped. Communism is stupid from beginning to end. The point is their goal was not this universal, you know, world of peace. Their goal was to spread communism. And he explicitly here refers to the uniformly peaceful and victimized policies of the Soviet Union. I mean, that's weird to me. And it's almost nonsensical.
Rothbard was very much a student of the early Cold War revisionists like Denna Fleming, for example.
Right.
And okay, so taken that this is a point that would also seem jarring to people. And by the way, let me tell you, as I told you through email, I don't think The Betrayal of the American Right is your first Rothbard book, you in general. I don't think that's the one you start with, because it's full of a lot of things that are hard to take and that maybe you'll never accept, or maybe you'll accept only after hearing them 80 times and seeing the evidence laid out. It is a tough book. Let's go into some things. I mean, I know there are some general things that you liked about it, but is there anything you learned about it from it that you didn't know before, that major things that are going to help you in any of your own work?
Yes, I learned that libertarian infighting has always been part and parcel of the movement, that this is nothing new. And it just gave me this – I mean, I read this to get an impression of Rothbard the man, because a lot of the things in this book have also been expounded upon and treated at greater length in like Brian Doherty's excellent book, Radicals for Capitalism. And he really talks a lot about what he calls the paleocons, the old right, whose ideas I think are having a renaissance now in certain segments of the Trump campaign. So when he kind of, you know, for many people, the Trump campaign kind of came out of nowhere. And this book is almost a bridge. It says, no, a lot of these ideas have had a history for 80 years, but they've been subterranean. So he really is superb at explaining how an ideology has morphed and shifted over time. But at the same time, this, you know, he tries to claim that he has been ideologically consistent, whereas every 10 years he's jumping on a different bandwagon. I think his strategy has been very scattershot, and that's another problem I think with libertarianism. Like, there isn't really a great working strategy that we figured out yet, or else we would have, you know, a libertarian society.
All right, I agree with some of that. I do think that it's kind of like Ron Paul. When he speaks to a group of evangelicals, he speaks to them differently, but he's still preaching the same basic message, just explaining it to an audience so that they can get it. Rothbard was still extremely laissez-faire All through his time with the New Left, he was trying to bring them over on this. And he did bring over Carl Hess for a time anyway. He did reach some people that way. So he was, I mean, he's, you look at his output at that time, it's all gold standard stuff. And he also wrote about the corporate state, stuff like that, so that he could have some things to talk about with these people. But I think he basically did hold more or less the same views with some things that he admitted he changed later on, like immigration. But I think it was a matter of, before the internet, these alliances really matter, because it's expensive to have a publishing house or a magazine or a newsletter or conferences. But now that we have the internet and anybody can publish anything almost for free, it's not so important that we're aligned explicitly with this leftist group or that rightist group. We could just be ourselves, and we don't have to worry about the sorts of things that Rothbard, who's building a movement from zero and necessarily going to make mistakes here and there, had to worry about.
That's fair. But I mean, you know, when he goes after Goldwater and thinks that Goldwater is the worst thing ever, it just seems very hard to kind of wrap my head around.
Well, my view is that we got the foreign policy that Goldwater was likely to implement anyway with LBJ. You know, we got that same thing. We got the Vietnam War. We got all this stuff. So if I'm going to have the same foreign policy either way, then I'd rather have the guy with the better domestic policy, which is why I basically would have favored Goldwater.
Right, but he's saying that he was desperate.
Oh, I know. Yeah. And I understand.
Okay.
I can respect people who take that view, that who say that his foreign policy is just so bad that I just can't lend my name to this at all. Maybe I would have said that at the time if I were listening to him day in and day out.
There was this famous ad that ran only once that Lyndon Johnson ran, the Daisy ad, which shows
Earl
picking the petals from a daisy and counting down 5, 4, and then it turns into a mushroom cloud.
Yeah.
And the point being, if Goldwater's president, you know, we're going to get nuked, or we're going to nuke somebody else. And as someone who has been the victim throughout his career of horrific smears and of being accused of being, you know, everything from a communist to a Nazi to a fascist to a Klansman, for him to approvingly say, yeah, that's right, if Goldwater's president, it's going to be nuclear war, I mean, I think that is a bit much.
Yeah, that ad was absolutely horrific. And I think I have a feeling that if I'd been around then, that ad would have sent me over the edge and said, all right, that's it. Johnson has to be defeated at all costs.
Yeah.
After that. Yeah, absolutely. All right. Tell me some other thing. And now, as maybe obvious, we didn't rehearse anything. I just said, let's see what you thought about that book, and then I'll comment. And I'm looking, and I'm talking way too much, just because I feel like I got to defend Rothbard's honor on my show. I'm going to shut up more. I'm going to let you talk.
No, but
sorry,
I want to hear. I didn't come on here to, you know, denigrate him. I just am giving an honest impression of him, because he's there's a lot there. So when someone is as prolific a writer as him, when someone is as involved in politics, see, the difference between him and Rand is Rand was in her ivory tower. She wasn't making alliances with people. You know, she was pontificating on current events, but she basically kept to her own scene. Rothbard, you know, loved rolling up his sleeves and getting dirty and getting into the fray over 50 years. I mean, I think it was. So, of course, he's going to make some wrong choices just statistically. But it's also weird to see him defend those wrong choices in retrospect, as opposed to being like, well, you know, this was kind of stupid on my part. You know, when he's siding with SDS, you know, that free speech, college free speech movement in the late 60s, thinking this is going to be the path to liberty. I mean, this was the precursor to the social justice warriors. So
wait, hold on a minute. I am pretty sure by the end, he does concede that much of his outreach to the left really had produced nothing for libertarianism. And in fact, he almost says those exact words. It yielded nothing for libertarianism.
Right. But the point is, at that point, he should have known better. And it's just, I can't even wrap my, although on the other hand, maybe SDS was such a new phenomenon at the time that who knows what would have happened as a result of it would be his argument. But in retrospect, it's just baffling that he thinks, you know, the Black Panthers and, you know, the hippies, which is why Rand referred to Rothbard and his followers as hippies of the right, that these are the ones who are going to be libertarians.
I think, yeah, I assume he thought that they might be teachable, whereas the right wing was expelling everybody.
Okay.
And he thought, well, that's just hopeless. These people crave respectability. Nothing's going to come of that.
Right.
These people I'm meeting don't care at all about respectability, and they have some decent instincts that maybe I can cultivate. But what else am I going to do? I've been expelled from everything else, but yet I have a lot to say. So what else am I going to do?
You know, maybe it's a testament to how bad things were and how much we take for granted now that he has to like kind of fight for these crumbs. That everyone was so anti-libertarian, everyone was so pro-government that you got to latch on to whoever you can in the hopes of getting any traction. And the fact that he kept, you know, rolling that rock up a hill for all his life, I guess, is a testament to his integrity and, you know, belief in his views, which are true.
I think basically that is what it is. I think that's a very good way of putting it. All right, what else? We probably should limit this, but it's still fun to talk. Well, what other things jumped out at you when you read?
Well, I have to say, thankfully I read this. I don't consider myself a Rothbardian because he really has this in his view, government and business are almost big business, excuse me, are both kind of two sides of the same coin. And I don't think that I have as much animus towards big business as he does. He really thinks that they're the big, big villains and almost in a sense inseparable from government. And I think that it doesn't have to be that way. And that's a very Rand point of view.
Yeah, it's true that he does spend a lot of time pointing out, you know, this business lobbied for this and this one did that. And the emphasis is on the collusion between big business and big government, but probably, and I can't prove this, but probably as a corrective to what he thought was an uncritical embrace of big business on the part of the mainstream right, which there probably was.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right. Okay. Yeah. I especially in some of the things I write these days, I know there are some maybe left libertarians who think I'm too pro big business. I know their problems. But that doesn't mean they're always wrong, and it doesn't mean that I should cheer the enemies of civilization if they criticize big business. I'm not doing that.
Right, and it's like back in the day, one of the enemies of civilization in certain senses was the church, when you had church and state, you know, united, and then you have kind of, you know, these bad popes in charge of armies, bad things happen. Then when you have separation of church and state, people can look to churches as exemplars of morality. So yeah, when you have government intertwined with any entity, it's going to get horrible. But if you do have that separation, then businesses can go back to doing what they do best, which is producing things that we all need and want at a increasingly lower price and greater distribution.
You know, a part of me wants to say, well, what did you think about this? What do you think about that? But I really just want to know, you're one of the guests I can trust to know what's interesting. So I know you've taken some notes and stuff. I know the big business stuff, that's a big thing. The foreign policy stuff, those two are absolutely huge. What else are you thinking about this? Does he mention Rand in this book? I can't even remember.
Once he discusses basically that, you know, she and her, he's not dismissive, but he just kind of says it's really weird that she wrote this essay called America's Persecuted Minority Big Business. So he says, in contrast to Rand with her insistence on this, you know, what I've come to realize is that business has always been, you know, pushing for these kind of progressive controls. And he's right. I mean, that is true. But the point is, I don't think it's an inevitable function of business. And I don't think that's something that can't be worked around.
All right. I think, are we ready to wrap up? Do you have anything else you want to jump in with?
I know we didn't really have a kind of clear point, but I mean, that's the whole thing.
We just want to think through. Yeah, just think through your impressions reading this book.
The last thing I would say is I would highly encourage people to read him for the very reason that A, he's a great, great, fun read, and he will force you to think through all of your libertarian assumptions, and you'll see where you agree, and you'll see where you disagree, and you'll see where you really disagree with him.
Incidentally, I would add that if you were to pick up Man, Economy, and State, his great economic treatise, which is like 1,000 pages long. If you were to read the prose in that, you would think it was a different person.
Wow.
It is so dispassionate and technical that it does not read in any way like The Betrayal of the American Right. So he was able to seal that all off. That was almost like a pleasant diversion for him.
Huh. But
when he was doing his academic work, it was super precise and like a laser beam. You should just flip through at random to different pages in that book, and you'll say, you'll agree with me that it is quite interesting to see that when it came time to do scholarly work, that's what he did. And he didn't have his, any snide asides or whatever. He would say things like, Professor so-and-so has overlooked the... He wouldn't say, this commie bastard has no idea which end is up. There's none of that.
And that's something Rand couldn't do.
Yeah, that's true. But yet, you know, I appreciate them both because I, in some ways, I liked Rand's nonfiction at least as much as her fiction, because I would read her demolishing somebody and I would just think, good thing she never met me. I wouldn't want to be on the receiving end of one of these essays.
The vitriol is wonderful.
It is unbelievable. It's incredible. But that makes it to me anyway. And it's not everybody's cup of tea, but it sure is mine. I really was energized reading her denunciations of various kinds and usually denunciations of ideas like the new left, the anti-industrial revolution.
Right.
You know, these people protesting against the system that's done more than everything else put together to elevate people to some level of material dignity. And this is the thing they want to overturn. This is morally despicable. She has no truck with them at all. Not the, but they're idealists and let's at least steer them onto the right path. No, no, no way. No, I'm not interested in steering them. Yeah, I'll steer them over this cliff. That's where I'll steer them.
Exactly.
And sometimes you need that, Doug. You know,
yes.
I'm all in favor of people who want to play nice and go talk to people. That's great. And I do that sometimes. I have a lot of converts I can point to, but sometimes you got to just come out swinging. And Rothbard and Rand, in his or her own way, did that in just classic style.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when she passed away, someone in her circle said, they sighed and they said, oh, the anger is gone. And it must be hard being angry all the time. I wouldn't want to be angry all the time. But boy, is it fun to watch someone who's angry for the right reasons, you know, just hitting people where it hurts with you know, correctly.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Anyway, very fun and interesting stuff. So read this book, but read Rothbard in other ways first. I'm saying, telling the listeners. So what I'm going to do at tomwoods.com/818 is link to this book, but also link to an article called Read Rothbard that goes through maybe his top 10 things, and then you can pick from that. So you have to read at least one thing. So even if it's something small, like what has government done to our money, read that, then read The Betrayal of the American Right, and then I'll stay on Malice to diversify his Rothbard holdings. But anyway, thanks a lot, Michael. Great talking to you.
Thanks, Tom.
All right, that's going to do it for today. I got events coming up February 25th in San Diego and April 4th in New Haven, Connecticut at Yale University. Get the details at tomwoods.com/events, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.